Here are four principles for living like an American. Protect freedom. Take responsibility at all times. Express gratitude for every gift and opportunity. Become a source of love. Once again, these are the times that try our souls. We must find the strength and the courage to rise up to refound America in the spirit of liberty. Well, welcome to Refounding America and Reclaiming Ourselves. If you're watching, you're watching Brighty on TV, and you can get us in our archives on brighteon.com. And if you're watching on the radio, it's through prn.live. We have a very good program today with Alex Newman. I'll introduce him a little bit more as we go along. And he is a man with just very broad knowledge and writes for the best newspaper in the world. So you'll have to wait to hear what that is. The following week, we're going to have breaking news by the man who disclosed, remarkably, makes me stutter, that the CDC admits it hasn't been following its own system, the VAERS system, for getting an analysis of adverse effects. It's been ignoring its whole big system. Wow. We knew that. We couldn't believe they'd admit it. See you in a minute or two. So Alex Newman, folks, he's the kind of man that we really depend on. I was teasing with him when we started talking. I'm 50 years older than him. He's going to be leading much of what goes on in the journalism era, the journalism area, I should say, of freedom in America. I can't overemphasize the importance that he has. He's a journalist, he's an author, he's a speaker, he's an investor, he's a consultant. From my viewpoint, he is a columnist on the most important newspaper now available, the Epoch Times, E-P-O-C-H, the Epic or Epoch Times. And he also is the host of the Sentinel Report, which comes out daily, and I'd like to have him describe all of this to you before we start to talk on various subjects. And he also is a correspondent, senior editor on The New American. So he is doing a lot of things to alert the world, to alert America, to alert other parts of the world to what we're doing today. And he's covered my work, and I'm just delighted to have you on the show today, Alex. You've introduced yourself a little more, if you like, and maybe more personally, And you've said you'd like to talk about education, which is something we have not adequately covered on Refounding America. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Brigham, for having me. It's an incredible honor to be here with you. I love your show. I'm a huge fan of your work. And it was a tremendous honor to be able to interview you a few times to just your incredible knowledge on what was going on with the global predators. And in fact, I've started borrowing your terminology. It's just hitting the nail on the head. So it's a real honor to be with you here, Dr. Brigham. So as for me, I've got a strange background. I've grown up all over the world. I've lived in 8 different countries on 4 different continents. And journalism is kind of my main gig, I guess, if you will. I like to investigate lots of different things and connect dots that other people don't realize are connected. And education has become such a passion of mine because as I'm looking around at the mess that we find ourselves in as a society, the common thread that runs through all of them is the reason we're here is because our children are being indoctrinated. They're being dumbed down. They're being taught things that are absurd. They're being denied their history. They're being turned into functional illiterates. And none of these horrible things that are happening to our country, these deceptions, these attacks on our fundamental freedoms, none of these would be possible if we had a well-educated, clear-thinking citizenry with a good understanding of our history, our heritage, of how to pursue truth. And so that's why I've made education such a central part of my work. I think if we're going to restore freedom, if we're going to preserve our republic and our free political institutions, it's going to require addressing this crisis that we have in our so-called education system.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I often just lament how little interest I ever showed in the deterioration of our culture as it's been taking place. And I've been, you know, fighting psychiatric abuse most of my life, as you're aware of. And I mean, it's like, where was I and where were we? Give us some history of this this awful development. I go back to the 1950s. I graduated in high school in 58. I don't remember any sympathy to progressivism or any sympathy to the right wing. In fact, I wanted to be more progressive, and I managed to get some copies of communist-oriented newspapers, always wanting to be on the cutting edge, as I did, but I had no one to tell me what was wrong with all that, and had to figure it out for myself because nobody was openly even discussing what was the matter with communism. We took America for granted. So maybe I've just stumbled on part of the problem. We were never openly attacking communism. We knew it was bad, but we weren't discussing it. Does that ring true?
Well, I think you actually just hit on something that is so critical to understanding this story, Dr. Breggin. And I've studied in a lot of depth the history of education throughout human history, and then especially the American educational system. And the first person that I can ever find talking about this idea that the government ought to educate children was actually Plato. Now, you know, a lot of people who've never read Plato, they want to sound all sophisticated, and so they'll throw out a quote they heard from Plato, and they think it makes them sound smart. When you actually read Plato's writings, I mean, you know, like a blind squirrel occasionally finds a nut, but the guy was a totalitarian. The guy believed that we should have philosopher kings rule over us, and that we should have a state-run education system that would train up the ruling class and then the rest of us to be subservient to the ruling class. It's very communistic, if you will. Of course, the term didn't exist back then, but it's very much in line with what Plato believed. And this idea wasn't really...
But, you know, it fits with the Great Reset, too. I mean, that's right. Exactly what Schwab and Klaus Schwab and Bill Gates and what they want to do, and is what the communists are doing.
That's right.
They really, this is what they want. They want this global governance by their superior elite.
That's
so
right.
Platonic. It's amazing.
Yeah, technocratic rulers that will tell us what's best for us, and we just passively submit because we've been conditioned to do that. And so, you know, this idea of government education didn't really get taken. So a couple of the Greek city-states tried it. You know, Sparta, the fascist regime in Sparta tried it. And, of course, we know how that turned out. Sparta would not have been a nice place to live for a freedom-loving person. But the first real person that I can find seriously proposing that the government ought to educate children. It's actually a very recent development, right? For 2,000 years of church history, it was always understood that parents were the primary educators of their children, and sometimes the church would play a supplemental role, especially, you know, after the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther was really a big advocate of the church getting involved in the education. But then in the early 1800s, an actual communist who believed almost essentially the same things that Karl Marx believed, although Karl Marx hadn't come along yet, his name was Robert Owen. He came up with this idea that we needed a communist utopia, that if we could just get rid of private property and if we could just pry children loose from their families and have the collective raise them, that all of these human miseries would disappear. And he actually started a commune in Indiana. It was called New Harmony. He was fairly wealthy. Yeah. He was a textile manufacturer. The commune obviously didn't last. It survived, I think, for 2 years before it imploded. And he came to this conclusion that the reason it had failed was because these children had been raised in this kind of, he viewed it as an individualistic, a selfish culture, kind of modeled on biblical ideals. And he thought we have to get rid of that. And the way to do that is to have the state take over the education of children. Again, this is the early 1800s. And he didn't come out and super openly start preaching this. He did write some essays about it. And we know from his autobiography, this is the main source we have for this, but we know from his autobiography that the Prussian ambassador picked up copies of these essays he was writing where he argued for state control over education. And the Prussian dictator actually liked this idea. He said, hey, we should implement this. He ordered his interior minister to start putting this into action in Prussia. And it was the first example we have of education of the state, by the state, for the state. The purpose of education then became not training up children to pursue truth and things like this or how to think. It was, you know, how do they become good citizens? Will they go to war when I tell them to go to war? Will they pay 50% of the taxes when I demand it? So that was the purpose. Now, it caught on in Prussia. It didn't catch on in America. But Robert Owen did set up a secret society, and I don't mean to sound conspiratorial, but there's a lot of evidence for this. In fact, one of the members of this secret society, his name was Orestes Brownson, a prominent man in his own right. He eventually became a Catholic, and he came out and blew the whistle on what Robert Owen and his band of conspirators were up to. And he described it basically as a plan to do two primary things: shift public opinion in favor of having the state become involved in education, and also to get men elected to legislatures who would support this idea of government-controlled education. And he said, actually, Orestes Brownson, the whistleblower, said the ultimate objective was, and I'm quoting almost word for word here, the ultimate objective was to destroy Christianity, to set up first a state-controlled education and then a national government-controlled education system, and to gradually remove religion and train people up for a collectivist society. So with that implemented in Prussia, a man in America called Horace Mann, he very prominent individual in Massachusetts. He actually was affiliated with Harvard, like you. and he had the backing of a powerful group of these utopians. They kind of rejected the Christian heritage of Harvard, and they wanted to move in a different direction. And so he got himself elected to the legislature, and then in the late 1830s, he became the first ever Secretary of Education. No state in America had ever had a Secretary of Education before. So he gets himself selected as Secretary of Education, right away starts expanding this network of government schools. He sets up what he calls normal schools, these state-controlled teacher training facilities, and brings in the Prussian model into Massachusetts. After he finishes in Massachusetts, he quits. He goes around the country and starts telling state legislatures, hey, it's working great in Massachusetts. You ought to try. And then by the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s, most of the states had established some sort of government schools. Still, most Americans were not educated in public schools. That change didn't happen actually until World War I, when officially most Americans were then in public schools. But John Dewey comes along. And John Dewey seizes on this architecture. He gets a big grant from the global predators. Actually, the Rockefeller dynasty gave him more than $3 million. He set up an experimental school at the University of Chicago and started basically hijacking and weaponizing this system to promote his ideas. He was one of the authors of the Humanist Manifesto, which basically is just communism masquerading as a religion, right? They tell you that we got to get rid of the profit motive. We've got to have collective ownership of the means of production. And gradually, you know, it was a gradual process because as John Dewey himself admitted in an essay he wrote, change must come gradually. To force it unduly would compromise its final success by favoring a violent reaction. So it was a gradual change. And that ultimately set the stage for where we are today, where over a multi-generational time period, they turned the schools into basically indoctrination camps to teach the children to submit to collectivism and ultimately, I think, this great reset global tyrannical system that they want to see.
The pull of collectivism, folks, on intellectuals is just astonishing. And the more we, in our book, Ginger and I, COVID-19 and the global predators, the more we delved into it, the more it was clear that even a lot of American CEOs and Bill Gates and Klaus Schwab, they had in the back of their minds ultimately a collective which they as elites ruled over. And sometimes the words would even come out that they were looking at a more collective viewpoint of humanity. And they would never specify their governance. And the reason for that was is they were just working on how they were going to manage to govern us, and they certainly weren't going to tell us. I'd like to explore an area of this that I have kind of a lack of knowledge but a great interest in. our founders, Ben Franklin and George Washington and Madison and Jefferson and so on, they knew that, and they thought that we needed a moral society that had a Judeo-Christian biblical understanding that they shared. That's my understanding. They knew this had to be the basis of a society, or it simply couldn't last and support freedom. It could. It had to believe freedom came from God, and we and that it was a individual right given, but not by the government, but by God or nature's God, according to Declaration of Independence. Where was the educational system there, and how did they expect us to have a moral citizenry?
It's interesting that you point that out, because they actually said specifically in the Northwest Ordinance, when we were bringing in some of what then were the Northwestern Territories, Ohio, Michigan, you know, that kind of region, that education and morality are critical to a free society. And they said that religion needed to be a part of that. So they very much believed that religion and the Bible were an essential part of education and government. In fact, the principles that they distilled and turned into a form of government, if you read their writings, they actually were very open about the fact that these came straight from the Bible. The individual that they quoted more than any other in their writings was the Apostle Paul. He was the most quoted figure by the founding fathers. And so they understood very clearly, as basically every generation of people in what eventually became the United States did, that a free society depended upon the principles and the values and the moral truths that were revealed in the Bible. And so you look, for example, at the very first settlers, right? Of course, you had Jamestown, and that was a Christian colony. But the real seeds for what eventually became America were planted in what would eventually become Massachusetts with the Pilgrims and the Puritans. And that was really a Bible colony. The first education law that they ever passed, the first education law ever passed in North America, was called the Old Deluder Satan Act. And the premise was that Satan wants people ignorant of the Bible so that he can manipulate them, so that he can deceive them. And that is why everybody in this colony must learn how to read. And so they actually said, if you're in a town of 50 people, you know, the town needs to make sure that every child knows how to read, and because that way they can read their Bible, and that way Satan won't deceive them. And that's what the founders believed. In fact, John Adams said that without morality and religion, this Constitution is not going to be adequate. You cannot control people. So I think really these things are all inseparable. And even after the public school system as we know it was born, that was still a big part of it. It actually wasn't until a lot of people struggle to realize this, because it's just been erased from our history. But even up until the early 1960s, and you probably are very familiar with this, Dr. Bregan, school children still said prayers. They still read from the Bible during the assemblies. Those things weren't struck down by the Supreme Court until the 1960s. And I mean, it actually shows you how dumbed down and ignorant our people had become, that the Supreme Court could say the First Amendment means you can't have a Bible or a prayer in school. I mean, when the founders wrote and ratified the words in the First Amendment, most of the states actually had established churches. Now, I'm not going to argue in favor of an established church. In a diverse society like ours, I don't think that's possible or desirable anymore. But the idea that the founders meant to prohibit Bible and prayer in a school because they wrote the First Amendment prohibiting a federal establishment of religion, they said Congress shall make no law, is simply ludicrous. They would have looked at that and said it's impossible to have an education system without the Bible. Horace Mann was the first one that I can find that seriously proposed getting the Bible out of the schools that he was creating, and that was not taken seriously. That was regarded as one of the most idiotic, ludicrous things that a person could say. So the founders really viewed the Bible, even the non-Christian founders. You know, there's a lot of questions about whether Thomas Jefferson was an actual Christian. He gave a lot of indications that he may not have been. But even he said, you know, the Christian morality is absolutely essential to the functioning of a free society.
Yes, Thomas Jefferson had actually, I don't know if it survived, but he wrote an edited version of the New Testament, taking the good stuff out.
No more miracles, right? Just the moral teachings.
Now, I'll give you some personal history that I've never discussed. It's not earth-shaking, but you're right. When I was in elementary school, which would have been, you know, up until around, I don't know, I graduated in 54, so you can figure high school. But throughout elementary school, Mr. Rose, I believe his name was, or it could have been Rhodes. That's how vague the memory is, but was a distinguished gentleman. And every Thursday we had an assembly, a full assembly, and he read from a huge Bible that was set up on one of these Bible holding stanchions or whatever they're called. And we had a fairly large Jewish community out in Long Island. And I believe he read mostly from the Old Testament. I had no religious education whatsoever. I was Jewish, but raised entirely secularly. And I was enthralled with it. I was not bored at all by this. I would just listen as literally, I think, kindergarten and first grade to him reading once a week from the Old Testament. It seemed full of meaning for me. And it actually became a deep part of my unconsciousness that I would later discover, believing there were books with great depth and meaning to them, and I should read them, and maybe if I was, blessed, I could write some. I mean, that little bit of exposure was transformative to me about knowledge and morality and its meaning. Now, still not clear to me, if the founders wanted this to happen, how did they, when they gave an order for all the children to learn to read, how did they expect it to be implemented in a general way?
Well, at the federal level, our founding fathers believed that there should be absolutely no role for the government when it came to education. And at the state level also, it was just completely unthinkable that a state would be involved in education. Again, it wasn't until Horace Mann in Massachusetts that any state ever really took any interest in education. That old Deluder Satan Act, actually what it asked was that communities, and Thomas Jefferson was a believer in this as well, that local communities, the parents in a local community, get together and erect a little schoolhouse and maybe hire a teacher together and determine what their children should be taught. And so that's kind of the origin in America of the one-room schoolhouse. It's just, parents in a community come together, and when they're not homeschooling, which the bulk of education for most of American history was homeschooling. You learn from your mom, from your dad, from grandma, aunts and uncles and things. That took place in the home. But then there'd be a grammar school and a one-room schoolhouse where you'd do some little bit of formal education before, if you decided to pursue college, maybe going off to college at 14, 15, or maybe 16. So the founders did believe very strongly in education. They believed an educated and a moral populace were critical to maintaining a free society. But they were rightly concerned about putting that kind of responsibility in the hands of either a state or a federal government. And I want to touch on something you just said, Dr. Bregan. I didn't know that about you. That's fascinating. But in 2014 and 2015, I worked with Dr. Samuel Blumenfeld. And he passed away a few years ago at the age of, I think, 96. But he was actually educated in New York City. He was Jewish. His parents had immigrated over from Poland. And he recounts in the book that we wrote together, it's called Crimes of the Educators. He remembers that when they used to read the Old Testament in the assembly, and he said it's some of his fondest memories from school. They would read Psalm 23, laying down in green pastures. And he said that stuck with him for his entire life.
Yes.
And even though there wasn't like religious education, there was no indoctrination, it gave kids a signal. There is a transcendent system of morality. There is a right and wrong. There is a source of truth. Whereas today, all of those things are just chucked out the window.
Alex, thank you for educating me and our wonderful audience. I don't think I introduced my show today by saying hello, hello, my wonderful audience. I mean, this is the first time I've slipped up on that, folks. A lot on my mind. There's so much happening in this world around us right now. And welcome, my wonderful, wonderful audience. I hope none of you are gone without getting that introduction, which I've done for my radio show for a couple of decades and always on this show, which is a continuation of it. That's all really good stuff. When we come back after a brief break, I want to continue wherever Alex Newman wants to continue. So just think about where you want to go with this. Show is yours. Well, hello, wonderful folks. Welcome back to an educational program that I'm finding very enjoyable, interesting, informative from Alex Newman. And go on to continue and update this discussion of education to modern times and to Klaus Schwab and the boys that are trying to run the world. Do you want to say anything more about what where people can follow you and, you know, keep track of you? Your work is really important. Your mind is just all-encompassing and it's a great resource for people.
Oh, well, I appreciate that so much, Dr. Bregan. And my personal website is behind me is libertysentinel.org. It's just kind of an eclectic mix of things that I collect and my thoughts and blog posts and things that I do. I'm the senior editor at thenewamerican.com, so people can subscribe to the print magazine or you can even get signed up for the free daily headlines. I'm the executive director of Public School Exit. You can find us at publicschoolexit.com. We're basically there to help parents and churches and synagogues and families and communities get the kids out of the public schools. You can find a lot of my writing at theepochtimes.com. And then I'm on a lot of the social media companies. I do have an account on Facebook, Twitter, but I'm also on all the good ones, Truth Social, Gab, Getter, and all those. So thank you very much for the opportunity, Dr. Bregan.
Oh, it's wonderful. Well, let's pick up. You said during the break that you'd like to take the discussion on about education, but to what they have planned for us under the global predators. One of the things that I think is so stunning that I hope you know more about than I do, it's certainly something I should know a ton about and don't yet, and that is that many, many of our youngest leaders now have literally been educated, if not brainwashed, by Klaus Schwab and his international organization that people know as Davos. Do you know much about that?
Yeah, in fact, I've been following Davos and the World Economic Forum for many, many years, long before it became so clear that these people were basically the front men for this great reset agenda, this global transformation that they're seeking to foist on us. It's very troubling. It's extremely troubling. What you see here is basically concentrate the pinnacle of corporate power concentrated in one organization, mixing with some of the most ruthless totalitarians in the world. And I mean that quite literally. The mass murdering dictatorship in communist China. Xi Jinping is always, you know, guest of honor, keynote speaker. During the Trump administration, these people were just lavishing praise on the guy as the keeper of the world order while crazy Trump was, you know, trying to ruin everything by getting us out of international organizations. So when you realize that the mega corporations and the mega banks of the Western world are just openly, flagrantly collaborating with brutal mass murdering dictatorships. I mean, the Chinese regime has murdered more people than any government in human history. And they're all working together and it's out in the open. There's no, you know, they're not in a smoky room somewhere. They're meeting in public, telling you what they're going to do. You realize that we have a very, very serious problem on our hands. And I think the World Economic Forum needs to be under tremendous scrutiny, not just by the public, not just by journalists, but also intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies. I mean, I think we're dealing with actual criminal activity here where plans are being made to overthrow our systems of government, where plans are being made to undermine our individual liberty. And these are criminal acts, right? Stealing somebody's liberty, that's a crime, right? If you kidnap somebody, you're taking their liberty. That's a criminal offense. And what these people are planning here is the destruction of human liberty. And that's not something that can be allowed to just continue.
Well said. I think that's incredibly important. And there's another organization with Michael Bloomberg, the World, the New Economy Forum, NEF, and he says the same thing. He brings together all these big banks and practically every big international corporation you can think of, and he co-sponsors with the Chinese Communist Party, which is mind-blowing, just one co-sponsor. And he has Xi Jinping, and he admires him and loves him. And he held his third or fourth conference right after, so he's much newer. But he's another billionaire. He's a real billionaire, which Schwab does not pretend to be, at least. But Bloomberg's one of the top billionaires. At this conference, they celebrated the news that a few months earlier in November, that Trump had presumably lost the election, and they devoted the whole conference to recoupling with China. That was the theme of the conference, undoing what Trump had done. And it was a virtual conference. It was, I think, January of 2020, probably, something like that. And January, February, in that conference, Bill and Hillary were there, and several members of the incoming administration, none of the outgoing administration. Bill Gates was there, and the CDC from both the U.S. and China were there, and it was quite a crew. And all of them devoted to globalism and seeing Trump and America First correctly as anti-globalist and obstructing their taking over the world. It's not a complex scenario. One of the things that interests me that I don't see too many people thinking about is this oddity of all these so-called capitalist globalists, which they're just predators. That's why I decided to use the term predators, because they're not a lot different than Xi Jinping. They're all predators, and they get together like maybe a pack of wolves might, maybe wolves from different territories, because they're more, a little more intelligent, so they gather together and they get a number of the bands of wolves together. But they're wolves, they're predators, and they want to wound their prey, and they want to keep their prey afraid and docile and be able to take them over easily. But what are our globalists thinking? The Western, I call them now the Western Empire and the Eastern Empire. And these Western globalists are so taken in by the communists. And I read something so interesting in a recent book, I can't identify it for you, where it talked about how if you're a Communist Party member, you do not have personal friends. Every friend you make is a resource of the Communist Party. So here are the Bushes, the presidents, and the family members thinking they're friends of the communists. And then there's, of course, our current president, latest estimate, $31 million accrued to his family by being friends with the communist Chinese. And, they have no idea that they are actually going to be eaten alive. And in the book, and COVID-19, the global predators, I tell them, Xi Jinping will eat them like sardines out of a can once they enable him to rule the world. Have you thought about that and those consequences at all, written about it?
It's interesting that you ask about that, Dr. Berrigan, because that's something that I have been covering my entire journalistic career. In fact, one of the most astounding revelations as I was kind of unbrainwashing myself from all the garbage that was pumped into my head in school and then in college was the realization that the spread of communism around the world had not just been facilitated by the globalist elites in the Western world, the super capitalists, the mega bankers, and so on. It wasn't just facilitated. It wasn't just enabled. It was driven by them. And so the amount of evidence on this is overwhelming, but yeah. I would recommend one good starting point. And you can go back to Karl Marx, right? Behind Karl Marx was this League of the Just that was, quite ironically, a bunch of industrialists, a bunch of incredibly wealthy people who financed Karl Marx and Frederick Engels, who himself was wealthy, in their exploits. But you look at the first major victory for the communists, and that, of course, was the overthrow of the Soviet, of the Russian Empire, the Tsarist government, and the implementation of the Soviet Union. And what you find there, you don't have to dig very hard to find the involvement of the Wall Street mega bankers. In fact, there's an entire book written about it by a man I consider to be one of America's greatest historians, Anthony Sutton from Stanford University. And this book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, he just gets the documents. He's got the documents straight from the State Department showing that some of the most powerful banking houses on Wall Street gave millions of dollars, back when that was an enormous amount of money, to disgusting mass murdering criminals like Vladimir Lenin, like Leon Trotsky. And then we saw, again, a repeat of that with the takeover of China. And I should add, too, that the Soviet Union was then built up by the Western capitalists, by the American mega corporations. We had the Lend-Lease program where Uncle Joe, the mass murdering butcher Joseph Stalin, had to be enriched, had to have factories built so he could produce tanks and bombs. Then we saw the same process play out in China. top-ranking members of our State Department, people like George Marshall, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, who served as Secretary of State and also Secretary of Defense, betrayed our ally, Chiang Kai-shek, the nationalist Chinese leader, literally put an arms embargo on the man while he's trying to fight off a communist revolution after they had finished defeating the Japanese. So they deliberately engineered the rise to power of Chairman Mao. And the New York Times and the rest of the fake media said, oh, they're just agrarian reformers. They're not really communist. They just want to reform the agrarian system over there and make it better. Then we saw the same thing again with Cuba, right? Our State Department put an arms embargo on our ally, Fulgencio Batista, and they sent weapons to Fidel Castro. All the while, the New York Times was pumping out propaganda. A man by the name of Herbert Matthews, another member of the Council on Foreign Relations, was telling us that Fidel Castro was an anti-communist freedom fighter, that he was the George Washington of Latin America. And so what you see is that everywhere where these communists take over, you see the Western elites behind them. And then you see the Western elites go ahead and build up those governments. The Communist Chinese was a very obvious example of that. Communist China went from a backwards, incredibly poor, devastated by famine. They couldn't even produce enough food to feed their people. Millions died of starvation, to now an industrial superpower that rivals the United States militarily and economically. How did that happen? Well, it happened through the deliberate intervention of the Western elites. David Rockefeller went over there in the early 1970s, and he actually came back. He wrote in the New York Times, you can still find this there, in 1973, he wrote a column, an op-ed called From a China Traveler, and this is how he concluded his piece. And you can go to the New York Times website right now, you'll still find it there, or at least it was there last time I looked. He says that the social experiment in communist China under Chairman Mao's leadership is one of the most important and successful in human history. And so they opened up the floodgates for capital and credit and for technology. And we saw that continue. And we see that continuing all the way up to the present day. And so the natural question arises, if communists hate capitalists and want to destroy them, why in the world are these capitalists helping these communists or supposed communists take over the planet? And I think it gets to what you're saying, Dr. Bregan. These people are not necessarily ideological. They are predatory. And communism is the ultimate predatory system because it removes all human freedom and puts all decisions under the control of the government. It is the ultimate manifestation of the system that the predator class wants to design for us. Now, they realize that pure communism could not survive economically. You know, you have the calculation problem where when you don't have prices, wealth ends up being destroyed on a massive scale instead of created. And so they knew communism couldn't sustain itself without being a parasite and sucking wealth out of places like the United States, which incidentally is what happened in the Soviet Union and many other places. So they figured out, hey, we'll keep the kind of communist party state, but we'll introduce enough market mechanisms where wealth will still be created. People will have at least a little bit of prosperity. We'll still keep charge, right? If you look at the top 25 companies on the Chinese stock exchange, every single one of them is majority owned by the communist party. So they still keep control over the economy, but they do it in such a way that wealth can still be created. But ultimately, I think if you want to understand what's happening in communist China, first of all, it needs to be understood that the Western elites, the Western predator class, the David Rockefellers of the world made this possible. They enabled this. They helped it. And then it needs to be understood that the globalist elites prefer the communist Chinese model to the American model. They want to be our overlords. They don't want to live in a world where we have God-given rights and the government is in charge of protecting those. They don't want to live in a world with rule of law where little people like us get free speech and get protections from abusive government. So I think China is both the key driver of the Great Reset World Order agenda and also the model. If you want to know what the Great Reset New World Order is going to look like if these people get their way, look at China. Look at Shanghai during the COVID crisis, and you get some sense of where these people want to go.
Everything you're saying is totally parallel with COVID-19 and the global predators. It's very interesting that we both come to such similar conclusions. You from years and years of study, although you're younger than me, and me from really just in the last few years diving into this with all my might. it's all real, folks. Now, one of the things that I found particularly interesting is that a lot of this funding of the USSR and other countries parallels to some degree what we're doing right now with the funding of the Ukraine and the stimulating and aggravating, as I see it, the Soviet Union, who is Putin is obviously not anybody's best friend but himself. The man's he's a KGB guy, you know.
That's right.
And he's a KGB guy running his country. But he differs from a lot of other people, in which he appears to be a patriot and an anti-globalist. He wants his own little empire. And he knows he's constrained by NATO on one side and China on the other, but he wants to rebuild the USSR empire. So he is a thorn in the side of globalism, folks. If you want to understand what's going on, I'd love to get your take back, Alex, on this. So I see that him, as he's this anti-globalist himself, who is being encroached on very mightily over the years by NATO, which is probably the largest armed force the globalists have in many, many ways, really, because the European Union is so globalist, it's quite bizarre. And they've got the Ukraine now. And take a look at, you know, people say that Biden doesn't know what he's doing. And I'm going to argue that maybe he doesn't, but whoever is running his show, whatever elder abusive individual is running poor Joe's life, does know what he or she is doing. And even when Joe Biden, and I'm just going to tie things in. Let me see, we got 5 minutes. I'll try to take only a minute or two and get your feedback because it's really important. When Joe Biden flubbed it all and left behind billions of dollars worth of equipment in Afghanistan, is that a failure? Not from the view of the military-industrial complex. It's an amazing success. It's like, oh my God. So then they can work with any administration, and even the heck with the administration, just work with the Defense Department and discuss how important it is to not only replace all that equipment, but to build equipment that we know can disarm the equipment they have and will be superior to the equipment we left behind. So it's a globalist bonanza. And when we give $20 billion or $40 billion to the Ukraine, you think that it's making it to the dinner table of the Ukrainian families and fighters? It doesn't get past the global elite, folks. They're just sucking the wealth out of America in this case. Higher taxes and inflation just sucks the wealth out of our country. And it's all going to the global elite. So I see them as managing wars, and that they have managed a lot of the struggle with the Soviet Union and then with communist China to the advantage of the military industrial complex, which is just one of the domains of the Western Empire. Alex, comment, please.
Well, I think you're exactly right. When you look at the global predators, it's helpful to think of them as kind of like the mafia. But I would argue that they're significantly worse than the mafia. When you deal with the mafia, at least they have some standards, right? They typically don't shoot each other's wives and children. You know, they typically have, they're monsters, but at least
patriotic too.
They are, yep. And you know, some of them, you know, they love their families. They have basic human values. They don't go after each other's wives and children. When you look at the global predator class, it's a whole different animal. I think many of these people are quite literally psychopaths. I think they have no feelings of empathy whatsoever. And it's hard for a normal person to understand that, because normal people don't want to kill other people. Normal people don't want to enslave other people. They might do small sins. They might tell little lies. They might even embezzle a little bit at work or something, you know, but they're not interested in enslaving people and building concentration camps and expanding their empire. When you're looking at the global elites, it's helpful to see them as kind of mafia bosses, but with even less moral standards and ethical standards. And so I think what happens regularly is, even though the global predators like to work together, it happens sometimes that there's a falling out. Joseph Stalin's regime was a really good example of this. Out of his top 34 deputies that he had throughout his entire reign of brutal terror, only about three of them, if I'm not mistaken, died a natural death. The vast majority of them were purged. They ended up, I mean, Leon Trotsky, one of the original revolutionaries, died from an ice pick in his head in Mexico City. So these people are ruthless. They regularly turn against each other. They all want to be the top dog. They want to be the most evil, the most powerful. And so that may be what's going on with Putin. I think for a long time, Putin and the globalists had a fairly good relationship. You know, him and Henry Kissinger have this bizarre little friendship. And Putin has written about it, actually, in his autobiography. He refers to Kissinger as his friend. He said, you know, they go and eat at each other's houses. And Henry Kissinger outlined in great detail his strategy for world order. This was a book that came out, I think, in about 2014. And he summarizes it in one sentence. He says, the contemporary quest for world order involves creating regional orders and then relating these regional orders together and creating a one world order. So you've got the European Union is a regional order. You've got Putin building the Eurasian Union, which they were openly talking about merging with the European Union for years. Now, it looks like it's a real possibility that Putin and the global predator class have had a falling out. I don't know if Putin crossed them or you know, they crossed Putin, or maybe it's a show. It's very hard to know because we don't have access to kind of what's going on behind the scenes. Right. But I think you hit the nail on the head with so many of those things. And the military-industrial complex, it is. It's a source of wealth that they can steal from us. It's a weapon they can use against normal people. And, folks, we've got to resist this. So,
my gosh, we're down to 57 seconds. I have learned a lot. You really helped refine some of my own thinking. It's astonishing how much we are thinking along the same lines about many different things. You will be back again on our shows. I'd like to have you back on our radio show for the maybe 9 or 10 times now. Ginger and I now have a radio show that we do together, and it's on America Out Loud. It's separate from this show entirely and the radio show that you're listening to if you're listening to this on the radio. Meanwhile, you've been listening to Alex Newman. Alex, in 10 seconds, best way to get in touch with you?
My email is alex@libertysentinel.org, or I'm on social media. Just look up Alex Newman.
Thank you for being on Refounding America and Reclaiming.